The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Time now for the second hour of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show here on News Talk 710 KNUS. This is an old Molly Hatchet tune called Fall of the Peacemakers. Well, I said this about a month ago, that now it seems that we are seeing the rise of the peacemakers, and particularly spearheaded by our President of the United States, Donald Trump, and his administration. Welcome back. It's News Talk 710 KNUS. I am Jimmy Sangenberger, and I am just extraordinarily proud of what has been achieved as far as peace in the Middle East and elsewhere under this president just in the past month. Remember when Barack Obama took office? He had hardly even set foot in the White House when he was nominated for and secured the Nobel Peace Prize. This week, President Trump, of course, was offered or was nominated twice for the Nobel Peace Prize. And guess what, folks? If anybody deserves it because they've earned it, it's Trump, not Obama. Obama got it for some flowery words, and then he got us in new Middle Eastern wars. Donald Trump hasn't done that. Instead, what President Trump has done is reset relations in the Middle East. As we've talked about on this show before, not long after President Trump took office, his administration took stock of what's been happening in the Middle East. And they recognized that under Obama, the United States of America cozied up to Iran and excluded Israel and our Arab partners to a large extent, ultimately achieving the Iranian nuclear deal. Truly faulty on every level. Thankfully, President Trump withdrew us from the Iran nuclear deal. But the Obama administration basically thought, well, we just need to appease Iran. Make them happy. That'll stop them from nuclear weapons, and it'll make things all hunky-dory in the region. Well, what they did in the process was ignore the Middle Eastern countries other than Iran, not named Iran, particularly Israel and the Arab nations, that understand that Iran is the lead troublemaker in the region, as former ambassador to Bahrain Sam Zakim has told us on this very program. They know that. They understand that. And when the Trump administration took office, they focused on that point, reasserting concern for over Iran and acknowledging that they are the main threat in the region to American interests, to the world's interests, certainly to the interests of other countries in the region. So by cozying up with Iran, Barack Obama was distancing the United States from other countries in the Middle East in a way that, interestingly enough, helped to start bringing them together from a common threat. Remember that Arabic proverb, "The enemy of my enemy is my friend"? It seems that the Arabic countries in the Persian Gulf, in the Gulf states, the Arab countries, they looked at Israel and said, hey, you're an enemy of Iran. We're enemies of Iran. You're our friend now. In some regards, and the Trump administration saw this and said, well, let's amplify this. Let's work with this. And totally changed policy in the Middle East. Also recognizing and acknowledging at the same time that economic ties are a critical driver towards peace, towards achieving security in the region. And so they put forward last year the economic leg of the unique Middle Eastern peace plan, Peace to Prosperity, that changed everything in terms of U.S. policy in the Middle East. And then the political aspect came out earlier this year. And lo and behold, after shifting policy, recognizing the sea change that was happening in the Middle East, particularly in the Gulf, you start seeing peace. About a month ago, the United Arab Emirates announced that they were building relations now with Israel. A momentous achievement. Now, just yesterday, the Kingdom of Bahrain also added its name to the list of countries that are opening up ties with Israel. UAE was the first under President Trump. Now it's Bahrain. We're expecting others, like Oman, for example. This truly is historic. Wall Street Journal reporting, quote, Bahrain and Israel will normalize ties in a U.S. brokered deal, President Trump said Friday, advancing a broader realignment in the Middle East as Israel and Gulf Arab states find common cause against Iran. The deal signals a monumental shift in the region where most Arab states previously had held off on making peace with Israel so long as its long-running conflict with the Palestinians remained unresolved. Last month, the United Arab Emirates and Israel agreed to establish formal diplomatic ties, the result of talks also involving the Trump administration. One of the things that President Trump's administration recognized getting into office, my friends, was that the way in which U.S. policy had been oriented in the Middle East was towards achieving peace between Israel and the Palestinians, which wasn't happening, has never happened, and kept failing, kept faltering. They decided to shake things up and instead turn to what's called an outside-in approach. That is to say, let's build ties between Israel and the Arab countries, get them fostering relations together, and then the Palestinians will ultimately come to the table. Now, so far, they haven't. Yesterday, the Palestinian Authority slammed the agreement, calling it a betrayal. Quote, this is an extremely dangerous step that torpedoes the Arab peace initiative, the statement said, referring to a Saudi peace proposal endorsed by most Arab countries. The Palestinians recalled their ambassador from Bahrain. Now, one might say, oh, this means that it's not working and it's not going to achieve peace between Israel and the Palestinians, not going to lead to a peaceful resolution. But if you're going to say that, you're wrong. Or at least you're premature. Because there's a lot to happen, a lot to come that will ultimately, hopefully, God willing, lead to that conclusion, that kind of resolution. But by the way, keep in mind that the UAE doing this and Bahrain doing this, they're not going to take that step without Saudi Arabia saying, yes, you're okay. We don't oppose this. We're fine with it. That is huge in and of itself. That is remarkable in and of itself. The idea that Saudi Arabia is giving the okay to other countries in the region, other Arab nations, to foster ties with Israel, it may be only a matter of time before Saudi Arabia restores relations with Israel, or for the first time ever, initiates relations with Israel formally and officially. In a moment, I'm going to play a few minutes from an interview I did with Sam Zakim, former ambassador to Bahrain and Centennial Institute fellow Samuel Lurie, just last month on this program, where we talked about some of this and what was to come and what was underlying these achievements. But before I do that, I want to underscore that it's not just the Middle East where we are seeing remarkable peace achievements. Here's an article from Rick Grinnell in an op-ed for The Hill, noting that the president of Serbia and the prime minister of Kosovo, quote, took an enormous step toward a long-term resolution of their historic conflict on Friday morning. At the White House, under the auspices of President Trump, their president and prime minister signed a brokered commitment to achieve economic normalization between the peoples and governments of Serbia and Kosovo. Writing this past week, and in reference to Friday, September 4th, Grinnell, who is the Trump administration's special envoy for Serbia and Kosovo and also the former U.S. ambassador to Germany, goes on to say, quote, ever since 2017, the U.S. position on the Serbia-Kosovo conflict has been that steps toward economic normalization will dilute the power and importance of the dispute's hot-button political matters. The parties have agreed to construct a roadway and railway link between their respective capitals, Belgrade and Pristina. They have committed to a joint feasibility study on options for linking the rail infrastructure to a deep-sea port in the Adriatic. We're talking the Balkans here, too. Peace in the Middle East, peace in the Balkans. Under President Trump, who has not started a new war involving the United States of America. And by the way, you notice a theme. A lot of what the administration is focusing on to foster peace is economics, economic relationships in these regions. It is truly smart to approach it the way that they have been. So if anybody has earned the Nobel Peace Prize on the world stage as a world leader, well above and beyond Barack Obama, not even close, it is President Donald J. Trump. Now, I do want to share some insights that we had last month on this very program from former Ambassador Bahrain, Sam Zakim, and from Centennial Institute fellow Samuel Lurie. Ambassador Zakim, can you speak to what Samuel Lurie is discussing and offer some insights on how you view the Trump administration's approach in the Middle East, what the administration identified, and how they decided to go about pursuing peace in the Middle East in a way that is different from previous presidents and policymakers?
I would say 100% I support what Samuel has said. Mr. Trump had the insight and the courage to enter into this area where nobody had succeeded before. And he is a man of his word. He gave Jerusalem back to Israel, the Golan Heights. He promised economic support for the Palestinians. And it's a great vision on the part of our president and Mr. Kushner, who mm-hmm. is in charge of the Near East at the White House. May I also give great credit to Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, the Crown Prince of the UAE.
Of course.
This year, he built the Abrahamic Center in Abu Dhabi, which had a mosque, a church, and a synagogue. The Abrahamic Center. This is the beauty of Sheikh Mohammed, and I got in touch with him, and I congratulated him through the embassy, through Ambassador Youssef Al-Arteba of the UAE, for the great step forward. It's about time. It's about time. Enough war is enough. Enough hatred is enough. Let peace come to the Abrahamic people. They're all Semites over there, and they should love each other rather than dwell on hate and hatred and conflict.
Samuel Lurie, let me get back to you on the subject of the Trump administration strategy here, because it truly is striking that what they decided to do was not get Israel and the Palestinians into a room together, as had been tried unsuccessfully before in previous presidencies. But instead, let's go to these other countries and try to mend fences with Israel, because that will send a message to the Palestinians. Hey, you need to get your act together, because we're starting to see these Arab countries have the rapprochement, as you've been talking about, with Israel, and they're getting on board. You need to. Now, this is the first country of the UAE. It looks like Oman and Bahrain will follow. Who knows when we might get to, for example, Saudi Arabia, which has already been at least opening up some dialogue and conversations with Israel, which has been remarkable, including the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman visiting Israel a few years ago to meet in Tel Aviv with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So talk to us a little bit more about that and how it can actually work and has been actually working, as we're seeing in the Middle East right now.
I think Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it best, and I think this is a sentiment that President Trump and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed share as well, that peace is established from a place of strength. It's not established from a place of concessions and making both sides have to make concessions. But Israel came from a place of strength. It did give the concession of, you know, holding off on any new settlements or annexation or anything like that. In the West Bank, which was important for the UAE. But ultimately, these are two very strong countries coming together who realized it was in their best interest to cooperate. And I think, you know, other administrations missed some of the secret back channels that had been developing between Israel and the GCC, the Gulf Council countries. And really, this is a new approach. And it hadn't been tried before. And I think President Trump, as a businessman, as a deal maker, just realized the Iran nuclear deal was a very bad deal. And he realized the U.S.'s strongest allies in the region, the Arabs and Israel, you know, how bad this was for them. And why would you make a deal that so badly disadvantages your friends? And so they found a way to broker, to work behind the scenes, to put together this Abraham Accord, they're calling it, which I love, because it's, you know, bringing together Jews and Arabs and all the children of Abraham. So I think really this is a monumental deal. It's a new paradigm. You and I talked about the new Middle East paradigm in our paper and just all the shifting dynamics at play. But that's just a little bit of it, is bringing these countries together from a place of strength that have shared interests economically, national security, so many different areas. And it's great to see it happening.
Former Ambassador to Bahrain, Sam Zakim, let me ask you about Samuel's point regarding some of these back channel conversations. There is a report from the Wall Street Journal yesterday that was talking about how more than a quarter century of deepening but largely secret business and security ties between the two countries, that is Israel and the UAE, were happening, were underway, and that helped to signal this shift to in the Middle East to greater peace. And what we've noticed, I think, is that what we're seeing now is that the Trump administration and President Trump, Jared Kushner, and others in their team have identified, to Samuel's point, these back channel conversations that have been going on for years and decided to really help to move those forward, to keep them going and to foster stronger relationships among these countries getting to this point, which is interesting because Barack Obama didn't seem to identify any of those back channels. Or if he did, he didn't seem to care about it because he was obsessed with placating Iran, which, of course, helped to tick off the Arab countries who felt like the United States was leaving them behind while focusing on Iran. And interestingly enough, one of the other things that President Trump identified was the threat of Iran being a shared threat among the Gulf Arab states and Israel. So I said a lot there, but what are your thoughts, sir?
I love what you said, and you explained it so well. this is a great day for not just for Israel and its Arab neighbors. It's a great day for the United States of America, having realized that the previous administration had been so anti-American in the course that it carried on with Iran. The Obama administration was a fiasco for our national interest in that part of the world. And thank God for the leadership of Mr. Trump, we are reestablishing ourselves as the leaders of that whole region and the whole world. And just imagine, on both sides, they look up to the United States. There was a time during the Obama administration where they distrusted us so much because of Obama's support for the troublemaker in that region, which is Iran and Hezbollah. What has happened now is reestablishing the greatness and the authority of the United States as the main world leader, especially in that region of the world.
And Ambassador Zakim, what do you think is the likelihood that we might get to a point where Saudi Arabia is added to the list of countries that have decided to normalize relations with Israel? Because when I recently interviewed, I've done two interviews with the spokesman for the Saudi embassy, the official spokesperson, Fahad Nazir, and the first interview I asked him about thawing relations with Israel, and he said, we have no relations with Israel, which is, of course, the official position. But is there a time we could see in the future, especially if President Trump is reelected, where Saudi Arabia actually does say, yes, we have relations with Israel?
I am very hopeful that under the leadership of MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, this is going to happen. Jimmy and Samuel, you both thought so too, and we the three of us agree on this, that God willing, Mohammed bin Salman is going to come out and say enough is enough. We are both Semites. We are the children of Abraham. We're the children of one God, and we're going to have peace and fight hate with love rather than with more hate, and be tolerant of each other and be respectful of the rights and the freedom of the Jewish people to live in peace in Jerusalem and in Israel.
So that's an excerpt of my interview from the August 14th, I think, edition of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show here on 710 KNUS with Ambassador Zakim, former ambassador to Bahrain, and Samuel Lurie, Centennial Institute Fellow. That was just after the United Arab Emirates had agreed to open up relations to forge ties with Israel, which was truly remarkable in and of itself. Now Bahrain, where Zakim used to be the U.S. ambassador to, Bahrain is now on the list, and it is going to expand. And Serbia and Kosovo reaching an agreement. How anybody can deny the fact that President Trump has done so much to earn the Nobel Peace Prize is beyond me, except for politics. Plain and simple. No ifs, ands, or buts about it, folks. It is remarkable what's happening. It is one of the key reasons why we need to re-elect Donald J. Trump as President of the United States in November, on November 3rd. I'm Jimmy Sangenberger. We're halfway through the show. Keep it right here. News Talk 710 KNUS.
stages, golden curtains filled by it, played as could be, as a rainbow grew around the sun. All my stars of love, the night came from somewhere beyond the sea to see. These lovely people played just for me. If I bid you see this place where stories all ring true, will you let me pass your face to see what's really you? It's not for me, I ask this question as though I were a king. Boy, you have to look, believe, and feel before the burst of tambourines take you there.
Green grass and high clouds forever, castles of stone sold.
Yes, folks, we are experiencing some green grass and high tides right now. With all the good things happening in the last segment, I was talking about Bahrain now coming to the table with Israel, forging relations with one another. A month after the United Arab Emirates did so with Israel, under President Donald J. Trump, largely brokered by President Trump and his administration and his team, led by the likes of Jared Kushner. Then you also had, a week ago Friday on the 4th, you had Serbia and Kosovo come together in a groundbreaking historic agreement. On the foreign policy stage, we are seeing some of the most remarkable successes of this administration. And that in and of itself is pretty darn good when it comes to the idea of like the Outlaws were singing among the best bumper music known to man 7 years running here on KNUS. Those are among the green grass and high tides that we're experiencing wonderfully across this country and across the globe. Yeah, there are imperfections. There are some things on the foreign policy stage that have been disappointing or that we might disagree with. I mean, of course, when it comes to trade with China, as you know, I'm not a fan of the trade war waged over the past few years. But I do at the same time agree that we need a tough stance on China in a lot of different areas. With Russia, President Trump has been blasted for being too cozy with Vladimir Putin. And yet it is Trump who withdrew from that nuclear weapons pact with Russia. And it is Trump and his administration who have pushed back on Russian aggression in a number of areas, while Barack Obama, he allowed Russia to make significant advances in Crimea. He withdrew the missile system plans from Poland, and the list goes on. You look at North Korea. I think that we were in a stronger position with North Korea earlier on in the Trump administration in some regards. But who else but President Trump would have literally brought North Korea to the table and held back some of their advances and their ballistic missile tests and so forth? And issue after issue, point after point, instance after instance on the foreign policy stage, the Trump administration has absolutely been excelling. You look at the judiciary. Same thing with the judiciary. Even more significant in some respects. Because what Trump is doing is not just the Supreme Court with Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, who overall have been really strong, but it is the appeals court judges, as we've talked about on this show before, who are now moving more and more in the direction of the Constitution, of constitutionalism, originalism, textualism. We see that in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Remember that the Democrats, when President Trump took office, the Democrats had 11 more appointments to the Ninth Circuit in California, the crazy, wacky Ninth Circuit, than Republicans. Now it's only three more Democratic judges, Democrat-appointed judges, on the Ninth Circuit than Republican. You look at the lower courts. The biggest reason, you recall, if you're a longtime listener of this program, we're 7 years next weekend. If you go back to 2016, in June, a month before the Republican National Convention, when I made my case for why I was going to be voting for Donald Trump, despite all my reservations during the primary, I said in June of 2016, biggest reasons are we need to defeat Hillary Clinton and the judiciary. And Donald J. Trump has far surpassed on the judiciary anything in my wildest dreams, my wildest expectations. Instance after instance after instance where we are seeing some tremendous progress on the judiciary and the foreign policy stage. You go to the environment and deregulation. Getting rid of this government knows best attitude. Absolutely, there are policies and things that the president has done that I think are inappropriate or that I disagree with. Everybody's going to find disagreements. And I think that, and I talked about this last weekend, I think it was a big mistake for the president to do that moratorium on evictions. And that's a grievous error. But I will take some of these negative policies, the what I would call bad moves on the part of President Trump, with the plethora of good things that we have been seeing, not the least of which, my friends, is the economy. We had one of the most robust economies we've ever had in this country before the pandemic hit. We were finally seeing record low unemployment levels among blacks and Hispanics and women and teenagers. We were seeing the labor force participation rate finally climbing up in a way we never saw under Obama. We were seeing wages growing, especially for those in the bottom quartile. All of these great things, and then boom, COVID-19 hits. The coronavirus pandemic, and then the policy decisions, largely on the part of state and local governments, to lock down their economies, to shut things down. That led to the economic malaise that we are now in and trying to recover from. We saw a dramatic hit in April as these shutdowns were starting to percolate across the country. The unemployment rate hit 14.7%. 14.7% in April. Then when the Labor Department's report came out on Friday the 4th of September, the unemployment rate they found had dropped in August to 8.4%. That is a 6.3 percentage point drop from the 14.7% level in April. And in fact, it's the first time that unemployment ticked below 10% since the month of April. That is tremendous progress that we are seeing, that we are experiencing right now. And it goes even more than that. The labor force participation rate, which was never rising under Barack Obama, is again higher. Labor participation in August increased to 61.7%. That's the highest level since March when this whole thing began. 147 million Americans are now employed, 3.75 million more, going back to where it was in October of 2014. Are we where we need to be? No. We absolutely still have more way to go. We're still recovering. And it's going to take a long time in some areas in terms of wages, for example. A lot of small business owners, because of these aggressive policies, have found their businesses gone permanently. Not because of President Trump or anything Trump did, but particularly because of these shutdowns. That's what's going on here. Don't let the left deceive you. What we are seeing is a recovery, and far more of a recovery than the 2010 recovery summer that Joe Biden, who wants to be the next president of the United States, was tapped by then President Barack Obama to oversee. We didn't see a summer of recovery. That's the legacy of Joe Biden and Barack Obama, is a failed so-called recovery summer. We have seen a recovery summer under President Trump. Joe Biden would literally like to shut the economy down again. He said so.
So if the scientists say shut it down,
I would shut it down.
The more that we get economic data, the more positive it is overall. And what's so interesting is when you look at the left and what they would like to see done, bailing out the states, massive government subsidization from the federal level down to the state level to certain sectors of the economy, more than a modest extension of the payroll or the paycheck protection program, and some of the other things that were in this so-called GOP skinny bill, the $300 billion coronavirus aid package that Democrats refused to allow to move forward this week, 52 votes, all Republicans, to get this thing going, except for Rand Paul. He was the one who didn't support it. And I can understand Paul's reticence. I don't even think we need to have or should necessarily have a $300 billion coronavirus aid package. But hey, Democrats are wanting something massively, massively, multiples times more. And Republicans are saying, no, we don't need that grandiose agenda that Democrats are suggesting. We need something at most scaled back, targeted, a skinny bill. And the Democrats said, no, that's not enough. We're just going to leave the Paycheck Protection Program and some other things high and dry because we're not doing nearly as much in this bill as we would like to see. They want trillions spent. Even as the overall economy is recovering faster than economists expected, according to a Wall Street Journal survey. Wall Street Journal reporting on Thursday. Quote, the U.S. economy and labor market are recovering from the coronavirus-related downturn more quickly than previously expected, economists said in a monthly survey. Business and academic economists polled by the Wall Street Journal expect gross domestic product to increase at an annualized rate of 23.9% in the third quarter. That is up sharply from an expectation of an 18.3% growth rate in the previous survey. Now, not only that, but one of the Federal Reserve banks, I believe it's the one in Atlanta, yeah, the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now model suggests about 31% increase in GDP for the third quarter. Now, you know that I'm not a big fan of GDP as a measure of economic growth, but that's a complex discussion. It still is a massively positive indicator that goes well beyond anything that economists were projecting, even discounting massive government spending. That's one of the parts of the equation of GDP is government spending. And it shouldn't be, but it is. And we're not spending as much as the Democrats would like to see, yet we are improving. What they would like to see, what folks on the left would like to see, is something more akin to Mark Cuban's proposal back in the spring, that the federal government hire, I think, 3 to 6 million workers for contact tracing and so forth, because it was going to take forever for the private sector economy to create more jobs. Well, folks, 10.6 million new jobs have been created in just one third of a calendar year. Nearly half of the jobs lost in the shutdown. without having a massive program akin to what Mark Cuban argued for. You will remember that on my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, Jimmy at the Crossroads, please subscribe on YouTube, youtube.com/Jimmy at the Crossroads. I debated Mark Cuban on this exact point, and I want to take you back. Listen to what he was saying and what I was saying and judge for yourself who was right.
About the compressed period of time, Mark Cuban, I mean, the idea of the federal government hiring 4 million people, you have to bring in all the job applications, then you have to go ahead and train them. You have to go through rigorous processes in order to make all those ducks get in a row. And by the way, I don't trust that the bureaucracies of the federal government are particularly effective at that sort of thing. How do you think that you can get this done quickly enough to A, have an impact, and B, make it so that, you know, I mean, the private sector innovation, what if during that interim time we have successful at-home tests that are produced well, produced effectively, produced easily for people to do, and you don't need to be hiring 4 million people because,
you know,
the private sector.
We can play what if until we're blue in the face, right? There's a lot of what ifs. You know,
yes,
if tomorrow
the,
they come up with a solution, then none of this matters, and you can stop the program. And I get the whole idea that once government gets started hiring people, it's almost impossible to take them off the payroll. And yes, that's the problem. I mean, I don't like that any more than anybody else. But you have to ask, where are we and what are we going to do to get forward? So will it take more time? Will it take some time for the government to hire that many people? Yes. Can they work within AmeriCorps and other organizations that already are used to hiring a lot of people? Yes. Will it possibly take longer than we ever anticipate? Definitely yes. But if you stack that up against doing it all privately, I just don't see a path where we can create tens of millions of jobs over the next 12 months. And even with all the waste, even with all the inefficiencies that are assigned to government hiring and government programs, they still will create the jobs that will amplify the demand, which will then increase the ability for companies to succeed. And that's what we need. Even when you have waste to show, look, any company that starts, no company is 100% efficient. You know, so a typical capitalistic company that's doing well might have 10% inefficiencies. The government might have 30 or 40% inefficiencies. But even after those problems with government, there's no other realistic business environment or private environment that can create the number of jobs that we need. And that's the bottom line.
I think the difference, and I appreciate it. I mean, you're very much articulate in presenting the perspective. I just don't have that kind of trust and faith in the federal government to do those sorts of programs.
We gotta let dogma go.
Not just about dogma. It's about practicality. And we've seen countries
across
the globe. Yeah.
So Jimmy, you're an entrepreneur.
I'll give you the alternative.
You're an entrepreneur.
Sure.
You've got to create 30 million jobs over 3 years.
Yeah.
Tell me what companies can do that.
So first
tell me
of all,
what 20 or 50 or 100 companies can do that.
I can't tell you a specific companies that can do that because I don't know. In fact,
or investors.
I think the greatest investors of all time.
Well,
but I don't presume to think that I know who's going to be the best investor, the best company to do that, just as I don't think the government is – that I can presume that the government's going to be effective to do it. I think if you start reopening, which isn't going to be an instant process because you do have, of course, you have a situation with reopening where not everybody's going to go to restaurants, not everybody's going to go to movie theaters and so forth. But if you begin that process and allow people to start their businesses back up and continue to provide some of the assistance that we've been doing, I think that could be much more effective, especially with a deregulatory regime, than having the government do what hasn't worked in the past, in my view.
I wish you were right, Jimmy. I really, really wish you were right. And prior to January of 2020, I would agree with you 100 out of 100 times. But this is not what we're facing today.
Unfortunately for Mark Cuban there, I was right. He was wanting to create 3 to 6 million jobs by the federal government because the private sector couldn't do it from reopening. Yet again, 10.6 million jobs have been created since our conversation in May. That is, I think, mostly since May. It might have been since April, but it was essentially in June, July, and August that we saw these jobs created. Nearly half of the jobs lost in the shutdown already brought back. Yes, again, we have a long way to go to get where we need to be. But creating 1.4 million jobs in August, the fourth best month since the government began reporting the data in 1939, as Andy Puzder points out on FoxNews.com, and 2.5 times better than any one month under the Obama-Biden administration. That's pretty darn good. And that's predominantly from reopening the economy, from getting the government out of the way and not doing as many expansive programs as the Democrats would like. Yes, a lot of money was spent. A lot was done to try to keep the economy afloat somewhat. And maybe it helped, maybe it didn't. But the bottom line is that it was government that was getting in the way of productivity. Government that was getting in the way of the American people being able to provide for themselves. It was government that was saying, no, you're not allowed to go to work. No, you're not allowed to provide for your family. Instead, you must be relying upon the federal government. Now that that's rolling back, things are starting to come back. Long way to go, but they're getting better. And all without significant expansions in the last few months of the federal government, all sorts of new programs. That's the lesson we should be taking from this. That's the lesson that we should be sharing with other Americans. That's what we all need to think about as we're going into this election cycle and we're talking to folks about the economy. Because it is positive and it's not government that's driving it. Keep all that in perspective. I'm Jimmy Sangenberger. That's it for the second hour. We got another hour up ahead. We're going to get local. We will talk with state legislators running for re-election here in the great state of Colorado. Keep it right here. It's the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. News Talk 710 KNUS with more conversations with the candidates. Don't go anywhere.